Happy New Year, everyone. It is early in the morning of Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. Don't worry about the number 13. I'm sure the year will be fine. I wish all of you some great good things, along with the mixed bag of things that this next year is going to be. It's been rather cold the last little while here in Winnipeg. 20 below centigrade in the last few days, and a little bit earlier it was getting close to 40 below with some of the wind chill factors. It's incredibly fresh in the morning. This last week my thoughts have been filled with memories of all the people along the way that have been so supportive of this perspective that I'm allowed to present on this website. People from long ago who were very supportive and in situations where I may have been having a lot of difficulty. People like Sandra Stewart and Link Phillips, who helped me with my books. I mean, Sandra was the first person that I ever tried to express this perspective to, and I mean, it wouldn't have gone anywhere if it wasn't for the fact that nature was expressing her in a way that she related very strongly to this perspective. I mean, much earlier, there were situations with my family and with certain friends that might have been very supportive through times when I might have been feeling a bit odd having this perspective in the first place. There were all the people that would come to the gatherings here in Winnipeg over the years, and over the years there have been many hundreds of them. All the ones there that related to this perspective. There was Joan Tollefson in her generous support of my books and her connecting me with Julian Noyce and Julian's willingness to published the books. And then along the way, naturally, Marcus Fellows, who read the books and offered to create this website and to post these talks each month, these responses. Often people have the impression that it's just one person presenting this perspective and they somehow are doing it all on their own, or they're the ones making big changes in so many people's lives. And it's not the case. It's that none of this would go anywhere. This kind of perspective couldn't go anywhere if existence didn't manifest a number of people that related very strongly to it, because it's not really one person teaching somebody else a perspective. It's a sharing of a perspective. And it's very much the expression of nature, the larger movement of nature that's occurring here. It's not a situation of cause and effect. In a way, it's like nature creates families of people, apparent people, birds of a feather, that somehow relate very strongly, and that's very much what's happening in this case, that in some way we're ripples in a particular stream in the river of life. And yeah, for those of us who relate to it, it's quite an amazing thing. And as I say, in this past week, my thoughts have been filled with the memories of all the people that have been involved with this, all the people that have supported this, all the people that have made this possible. And there's a very natural gratitude that arises with all of that. And yes, it's true. I mean, ultimately, all of that is a total fantasy, the fantasy of people supporting, the fantasy of me presenting this perspective. But nonetheless, the fantasy still presents itself. And in this case, the fantasy is presenting a lot of gratitude. I think in a way it's a bit like Einstein once said, time is a fantasy. But what a fantasy! And in the same way, our life journeys are fantasies. But what a fantasy! I've had about 9 people write in this month with comments and questions, so we'll get down to it. A first person has written in saying, "Hi Daryl, in your webpage you say that you felt that Robert Adams was an example of where your own life was eventually moving, but you also felt that you didn't want to get there quickly. So you went on to spend 6 years as a Buddhist meditation monk. Could you say something about this? Can you describe somehow what were the benefits of living as a meditation monk, if there were any? Thanks." All right. When I met Robert Adams, he was in his 70s, and he really didn't have much interest in any of the specific expressions of existence. He was very much resting with his focus on the larger event of the moment. And even though little activities in the moment would sometimes grab his attention, he was more at ease, just resting in that openness that is the entire moment. And I wasn't quite yet 40, and even though I knew that openness from years of exploring meditation, I wasn't quite yet drawn to rest in that all the time. So basically, it frightened me at the time to see his lack of interest in any of the specific events of the moment and his overwhelming interest in the larger event. But in my own apparent journey was compelling me to go off to spend time as a Buddhist meditation monk in England, under the guidance of Ajahn Sumedho. So this is in a Theravada Buddhist tradition. This particular one was coming out of northern Thailand, and Ajahn Sumedho's teacher had been Ajahn Chah, a very famous, internationally famous Thai meditation monk. So can I describe the benefits of living as a meditation monk? Well, it's a good life if you're called to that, if you're drawn to that. It allows you to live in a way that you don't have to focus on the usual worldly activities. You don't have to have a job. You don't have to be concerned about making money. You don't have to be concerned about what you're going to wear or, you know, going out to buy clothes. Because basically you have to wear a robe, have the same look all the time, basically. You don't have to worry about combing your hair because you shave your head. You don't have to worry about entertainment because you're not allowed to have entertainment. You don't find yourself eating at odd hours because you only get food presented to you in the early part of the day, and you're not even allowed to touch it unless it's officially offered to you. And in that situation where all of your escapes and distractions, or most of the usual worldly escapes and distractions, are set aside, and in fact you're not allowed to participate in them, very naturally you're left with all of the urges and activities of the brain as it's trying to escape certain things in life. So, you know, you're left with loneliness and confusion and fear at times. And when those arise in the night, you're not allowed to go eat something or listen to music or watch a movie, or you're not allowed to comfort yourself sexually, not even on your own. And you're left with the event of life and those basic fears and confusions and loneliness, as well as the moments that are joyful. So what you are allowed to do is rest with whatever life is expressing. So all of that's a wonderful situation for exploration and for maybe discovering that there really isn't anything you have to run away from in life. I mean, outside of a life-threatening situation, the rest of it you can rest with. Maybe if life presents you with that capacity. In any event, that exploration, if you're drawn to it, if you're compelled to explore life in that way, is very interesting. And there's lots to apparently learn there. However, from a non-dual sensibility, we really have to keep in mind that this is only if you're compelled to do this. If this is only if nature is expressing you in this way. For most of the apparent expressions of humankind, it's just not an appropriate way to be living. They're not drawn to it. They wouldn't find it interesting. And even if nature does compel you to live in this way, you're going to find out a few other things about large spiritual organizations that you may not have anticipated. So like any organization that has more than six people in it, you start having a lot of organizational difficulties. You have political factions that arise. You have, in a very long-standing organization, you have a lot of history. So you have groups that have been having difficulty with each other over a very long period of time. And there can be some very unpleasant things that arise. But that's not specific to any tradition. It's not specific to any organization. It's just apparently human organization and how that's expressed by nature. One of the great things about many Buddhist traditions is that if you are compelled to explore the life of a monastic, the life of a monk or a nun, many of these Buddhist traditions offer you the opportunity to explore it for short periods of time. They're not asking you for a lifetime commitment. So you can enter these situations and live as a novice for a year if you wanted to, or there are other situations, you know, beyond that where you might become a fully ordained monk or a nun, and you could live that way for 2 years, 3 years, 10 years, however long you're compelled to do that. For anyone who is dreaming or imagining that life in a monastery is going to be incredibly pleasant, and that to live away from the usual hassles of the world is going to be endlessly calm and peaceful, I just want to tell you straight out that that's not going to be the case. That you will find a lot of the same interpersonal hassles in the monastery as you would outside of the monastery, and often they're even more extreme, because these can be quite strong personalities that leave worldly life to go off to live this alternative lifestyle. And late at night, when those confusions and fears and the loneliness might arise, you're not going to be able to go out and wear off that energy by drinking or having sex or being entertained in some very strong fashion. All of those escapes are going to be taken away. So it very definitely has its ups and downs. You will also find that in many cases, you're not going to be left to your own devices, that the monastery itself needs to be, it needs a labor force, and you will be part of that labor force. So these are some of the things to consider in the life of a monk or a nun, a Buddhist monk or a nun, even within a meditation tradition. And just as a final comment, please keep in mind that if you're thinking that you need, that somebody absolutely has to live as a meditation monk or a meditation nun in order to become enlightened, that's not true. Throughout apparent history, there have been all kinds of awakened individuals that have lived in other situations. Some have been members of a family, you know, fathers and mothers. Some have been, well, they've been involved in all walks of life, scientists, business people, laborers. And this apparent awakening process is itself an expression of nature. It's not something that somebody is going to create. For those who are expressed in this way, they will eventually realize that all of this is simply the movement of existence. And it's not necessary to have to be awakened in order to be happy. There are lots of people in the world that are very happy, and they have absolutely no interest in anything called enlightenment or non-duality. So once more, the bottom line is that all of this is the dance of the Great Spirit, the River of Life, the unformed ocean of existence. However, if you are compelled to go off and live as a Buddhist monk or a nun, it's a great life. Another person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl. I have just read your book, Dismantling the Fantasy. Very interesting, and I love the way it cuts through even the most spiritual of concepts. I have a question. Where you state that after seeing through all beliefs about awakening, oneness, and a multitude of other concepts that we pin our belief of the self to, you quote that what is left is indefinable motion. Is this not a concept as much as the others in the sense that experience is only ever of one thing, and to say something is motion, there has to be a belief, memory, that something prior existed to compare the position of what is being experienced now? To experience motion, we must in a split second recall a memory that represented a prior experience, and this in itself is a belief or concept. Therefore, is motion what is experienced, or is what is just indefinable? It's just something that struck me when reading your book, and I would be grateful if you would comment or clarify. Many thanks." So, yes, I would agree with this person's comment, what it is he's wanting to be clarified here, and in fact, I state this very thing in the book, in Dismantling the Fantasy, so just let me pause this and I'll go get a copy and just find the pages where I do state this. Okay, on page 36 of Dismantling the Fantasy, I make the statement that the view I'm presenting is also a fantasy, but it will dismantle itself. And then at the end of the book, on page 88, I'm basically stating that if you relate to this investigation or this exploration that I'm presenting in the book, that what you will be left with is an incomprehensible happening. So you're left with a sense of wonder or puzzlement, because there's no way of saying anything at all about this, what seems to be happening in this moment. And yet, we can't really deny that it feels like something's happening. So we're simply left with puzzlement or wonder, and no possible way of saying anything at all about what is. The entire expression of Dismantling the Fantasy was simply a consideration of could anyone pick the book up and enter into a consideration of how we experience existence, how all of us commonly experience existence, and just start to consider that, and through the course of the book, eventually be left without any possibility of saying anything at all about existence. And there have been many people who have written in and said that's exactly what took place, that they began reading this book, and by the time they got to the end of it, they realized that all of existence was a happening that they couldn't say anything at all about, and yet here it was happening. So in the book, I've made the statement that the book itself, the dialogue or my portion in those dialogues is itself a fantasy, but it's a fantasy that will dismantle itself. And so it seems to be working with this person who's written in, because in their consideration of what's being presented in Dismantling the Fantasy, they're also finding it ultimately impossible to say anything at all about what is. So I hope that clarifies that point. Within everyone's usual view of existence, this apparent fact of change is very obvious. So it's a wonderful starting point in this exploration of our lives. We all have the impression that everything is changing or moving already. So it's not a matter of somebody having to go off on a big, on years of meditation training. It's just we start with a very obvious fact of existence and start to consider what that would mean about our existence and about our views of existence. And basically, it undermines our world of thought. And in some situation, in some apparent individual, such as this person who's written in, it becomes a real challenge to describe life in any way whatsoever. For some, it may be just enough to acknowledge that everything is a moving, shifting event, but in others, the exploration of that will automatically call into question any description of existence, even words like movement and flow. And actually, if I remember correctly, I'm not going to look it up, but I think somewhere in the book I even point out that words like flowing and motion, you know, these are just attempts to point to the happening of the moment without needing to describe it. And to use words like motion, constant motion is just the absence of any particular form. And it's this absence of any particular form that makes it impossible to describe existence. And then also within that consideration, we have the consideration of what it is we actually get with a word or a label. And ultimately, all we get is a meaningless sound. We're just trained to bark a certain sound. And in seeing that, we realize that, okay, you know, within the world of stories, there's no apparent form to be described. And with the labels themselves, they have no particular meaning. And then also for others, for other apparent individuals, the actual experience of the moment reveals itself to be a vitality and not something, it doesn't feel as though it's something solid and stable. It is a subtle dance, a vital, it has a liveliness to it. Vibration, pulsation. So it's a little bit different for each apparent person that considers existence or explores existence. Dismantling the fantasy is simply a general invitation into a more detailed exploration of, first of all, our general sense of existence, and then a more detailed acknowledgement of the moment. And every apparent individual brings to it a slightly different approach. So ultimately, though, if there is a strong consideration of what's being presented, it becomes very, very difficult to believe anything that's said about existence. All right. Another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, does anything really happen? I mean, events appear to happen and we name them events, but what is an event? I can't seem to verbalize entirely what I mean, but when I look at it, it seems obvious. Events and happenings seem to happen, and we name them according to our vocabulary. For example, the car drove down the road, the butterfly landed on the rose. But taking away the labels leaves us with an indescribable event, as you say. But in what sense did the event happen? if it ever was, if it ever had any substance to it at all, it's almost ghost-like, an intimation that something happened, but no trace that it did, only the situation as it is now, just now, which is ever-changing. I was brushing my teeth the other night, apparently, and this occurred to me quite strongly, that in reality there is absolutely nothing to fear. This is all a mysterious visual with an assumed solidity that vanishes into thin air when looking at it. We dance along in daily life, assuming that this is all so important, so real, and even dangerous, when it is nothing but a paper tiger, and even the tiger vanishes when looked at. What use is this observation? Or no, he's saying, what use is this observation? Well, there was a sense of relief and relaxation when this was noticed. It comes and goes as assumptions take over almost incessantly, but under all that stuff, huff, and guff is this deep, deep, deep awareness of a nothing that defies any attempt to pin a tail on it. I just thought I'd share this view with you. I thoroughly enjoy your talks and Q&As. Long may they continue, even though there's nothing really happening. Kindest regards. I just thought that I would read this out because it was a nice consideration. Obviously, this person is coming to realize the ephemeral nature of any of the forms that present themselves. Now, you know, in most cases, the focus is often on what appear to be very solid forms, the very slow moving, slow changing forms, such as a table or a wall or an automobile. But if we start to consider more subtle forms, such as a form that we would call a specific event, such as a car driving down a road or a butterfly landing on a rose, what we're dealing with in this case is an event, a form that we would actually relate to more as an action. So life presents itself in a certain way. It has no particular form, but it's possible to describe apparent forms. And so we have situations that get described, and that's a form. However, the situation is what we would normally call an event, a specific event, and that is something we would relate to more as an action, like the movement of smoke. So our descriptions about these kinds of actions are very much like taking snapshots of smoke. Now, you can take a snapshot of smoke and then show it to somebody and say, this is what smoke looks like, but that's not what smoke looks like, because that particular expression of smoke is long gone. Smoke has moved on to, smoke is now expressing itself in a very different way. So, these descriptions of form, they seem to describe something quite real, but it's gone in an instant. It never was a particular form. And in these situations where it's the description of an action, if we start to consider it, if we start to acknowledge these actions in a very sensitive way, it becomes very obvious how ephemeral the whole thing actually is. And so, as this person points out, it's almost ghost-like. And there's an intimation that something happened, but there's no trace that it ever did. There's only this in this moment. And even as I say there's only this in this moment, that's already gone. So So this was a nice consideration of just that ephemeral nature of existence and how it is that, you know, we think of life as being something so solid and so stable, and yet it's not when we examine it. This person goes on to say that, you know, there's really nothing to ever fear. I would like to point out that ultimately, from this non-dual perspective, it's true, because whatever happens, it's just this totally unexplainable presence or happening, this unexplainable function or dynamic. Nothing ever actually happens to that, and that is the fundamental nature of existence, just this. There's no way to really say anything about it, and whatever seems to be happening, it always remains just this, that has no particular form, and nothing can be said about it. It's just this. So nothing can happen to this, ultimately. It just goes on expressing itself in whatever way it expresses itself. However, part of that expression is what we would call a survival mechanism, an apparent survival mechanism that works in accordance with this apparent body. So, you know, we never will get rid of what we call fear, because that's also part of the natural expression of this whole situation. I mean, there may be an underlying sense of ease with this, the acknowledgement of this greater mysterious event of existence. There may be an underlying sense of ease, but there will still be an apparent concern for an apparent body in certain apparent situations, because that's all part of the natural expression of whatever this is. All right, another person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl. I'm so glad to find your site, thanks to a book translated into French that makes me know you. I really enjoy reading you and listen to you, and your perspective seems to find a true echo in me between all the different ways to present the non-duality and different teachers. Your voice seems so simple and true that seems to get me away from everything else, the blah, blah, blah about non-duality. In advance, sorry for my English, and thank you, Google Translate." Well, even if English isn't your first language, you're making yourself very clear in this. She goes on to say, here's my question. Through your proposal to observe what is experienced in the moment, I can totally feel what you're talking about, the appearance of form and its constant change through the senses and the mind, and thus its fundamental unreality. But when you start to talk about mountains, planets, and galaxies, which change over time, even if you do not see it, it seems to me that there is a jump in the concept, and it seems no longer appropriate to what my experience is of the present moment. Perhaps if I'm really in the nature, facing a mountain, I can see that the apparent shape changes constantly through light and color, for example. But seeing the mountain with the concept of time, the form that it was 1,000 years ago, the form that will take 1,000 years from now, is that not just another presumption, a belief in the idea of evolution? And the same with the idea about a galaxy or particles in our visible body. It does not stick to my reality at the moment, unless I see it simply as a concept, an image purely constructed by the mind, or simply a feeling and a kind of intuition rooted in experience. I hope you understand my question despite the difficulty of the language and the translation. If you could clarify this point, I thank you in advance, and I hope to have the pleasure to hear you soon. And once again, yes, I agree with this person's comment and the question as to whether this consideration of a mountain having no form, doesn't that lie within the world of concepts? And yes, it does. And I have no problem with the world of concepts. Within this non-dual sensibility, it's not that we're trying to get rid of concepts. It's simply that we come to realize the limitation of concepts. And this person who's written in here, as well as that person earlier, they're coming to realize the absolute limitation of concepts. Now, it doesn't mean we then live without concepts or dislike concepts. It's just that concepts themselves are perhaps acknowledged as a totally mysterious event. But one of the things I like to note is that even in the world of concepts, they point out that they can't be real, they can't be accurate. And so the concepts themselves support a non-dual sensibility. Most of the time, we're not really acknowledging what our concepts are telling us. The concepts themselves, if we truly acknowledge what they tell us based on our apparent experience, which is also another storyline, we discover that the storylines themselves begin to dismantle themselves until ultimately they too must simply be a totally mysterious event. Something that nothing can be said about. But once again, this doesn't leave us disliking concepts or wanting to avoid concepts. We're then left with the possibility of playing with concepts. And so within my writings, I'm using the world of concepts and playing with the world of concepts in order to point out that ultimately there's no meaning there. They can't describe existence. And a simple consideration of the concepts that we have will ultimately point to their absolute inability to really say anything at all about existence, about the apparent happening of the moment. But this consideration, or this apparent process that we might call awakening, even that's a storyline, this isn't going to leave us without any apparent thoughts. These apparent thoughts will still continue to be expressed as an apparent manifestation of this totally unexplainable happening. However, in considering their limitation, we are left with the possibility of using them or having them arise without the usual confusions that are involved in believing their storylines. So I don't know if this clarifies anything around this question, but it's all that's coming up at this moment. The next person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, thank you so much for your very clear expression. It has helped me tremendously at various points. I am, as you say, drawn to this non-dual sensibility. I have a question that you may have answered earlier. I don't know. I haven't heard it on your talks. As you proceeded along the spiritual path, did you reach a point where there was a sense of this non-dual perspective, but at the same time, the sense of a separate person instilled in us by society hadn't quite left? If so, what did you do or what happened next? It seems like there is a crossroads that happens where the truth is seen, but it keeps getting obscured. I think I remember you saying in one of the interviews that you realized that going backwards was part of the same movement. How did this non-dual perspective stabilize for you? Thanking you and Marcus for your work. Loving regards. Let's keep in mind that this apparent arising of a non-dual perspective is ultimately going to be the sense that there's no way of saying anything at all about what's happening in this moment or any moment, any apparent moment, that the so-called awakening is the realization, an apparent realization, that there is only a totally unexplainable happening or presence, and it's just happening or presenting all on its own. Just this being this. However, within the apparent world of form and the apparent storylines and the apparent life journey, in this situation of a non-dual sensibility arising, it may present itself in a way where it seems like in one moment we're absolutely certain, there's an absolute certainty that this is a totally unexplainable happening, just happening spontaneously, all on its own. Nothing else is occurring. And then in the next moment, we're kind of caught up in the storylines about being a person in charge of life. And that kind of flip-flop may present itself as some concern. You know, we're wanting to get rid of that flip-flop. But in fact, it's not necessary, because it may be acknowledged at some point that these storylines themselves are a totally mysterious event. So instead of getting totally caught up in the descriptions that they present of a life, of a person in charge, of a world of things, instead of getting caught up totally in that storyline, there may be a growing acknowledgement that this whole happening of this storyline is a totally mysterious event, just happening on its own. So when that apparent storyline is present, it's still just the totally mysterious event of existence. Again, within this non-dual consideration, it's not a matter of getting rid of the world of thought. It's a simple acknowledgement that thought itself is this totally unexplainable happening expressing itself. That really, we don't have to be concerned about what these apparent thoughts are or whether or not they present themselves, because all of that is a totally mysterious eventing. All of that is simply the mysterious presence presenting. Now, how much one is apparently drawn to this non-dual perspective, or let me say it this way, to what degree, to what apparent degree a non-dual sensibility arises, we don't have any say over that. It will present in whatever way it presents. And it will play out in whatever way it plays out. So, you know, I give a very general consideration of this perspective. I can't offer any specific way that this will arise for any apparent person, because in each case it's unique. But all the way along, it's just simply a consideration of life and how it's expressing itself. It's a consideration of these apparent storylines that we carry, and it's a consideration of the limitations of those storylines. It doesn't mean that we will get rid of stories of being a person. It doesn't mean that we'll get rid of stories of a world. It doesn't mean we'll get rid of the apparent descriptions of existence. It just means that we come to see the limitation of those descriptions and perhaps come to see that the apparent movement of those descriptions, the apparent arising and passing of those descriptions, is also simply a totally mysterious event occurring on its own. Okay, so this next person that has written in a question, but I have to explain that this person had sent me a link to a certain website, or a certain YouTube presentation, which presented these magnificent photographs of existence, all of these different aspects of nature that were beautiful and intriguing and marvelous and mind-boggling. But in that presentation on YouTube, each image was accompanied by a phrase from someone's teaching, the teaching of someone who is considered to have a non-dual sensibility. But in those phrasings, there was a lot of reference to a mind without thought, that ultimately we're a mind without thought or a mind free of conditioning. And coupled with these magnificent photos, it was very, you could get blissed out with this notion of being a mind beyond conditioning or a mind without thought. And the whole consideration of what we are is fundamentally this mind that is beyond all description. And I was pointing out to the person who had sent me the link that perhaps we might be careful with that kind of phrasing, because a mind free of conditioning wouldn't be talking about a mind free of conditioning, would not be saying that we're a mind free of conditioning, because the words mind and free and conditioning are all conditioned. And so this person has written back saying that there was somebody else that she had read about who arrived at saying that he just one day stopped thinking and that he could function without thought. But then he went on to have a career with as a scientist, and found that he could function as a scientist without thought. But again, I was pointing out that for someone to say that they live without thought and then to go on have a career that's totally based on thought, or in the case of this other non-dual teacher that was expressing this notion of a mind, that we are ultimately a mind free of conditioning, this person actually went on to spend the next 30 years writing something like 3,000 poems about being a mind free of conditioning. So that we have to really take a good look at what they're trying to express there, because if you really didn't have thought, you wouldn't have a career based on thought. And if you really didn't have any conditioning, you wouldn't be able to feel that you were a mind free of conditioning. So this person who had originally sent me this link eventually asked, am I not asleep because of my conditioned mind holding on to stories of a me that's not there? So perhaps we can consider that it's not a situation that you're a conditioned mind holding on to a story, because that itself is a story, that you're a conditioned mind holding on to a story, and that ultimately within this non-dual consideration, the consideration is a limitation of all thought and all stories, so that ultimately there's simply the acknowledgement that there's just this happening of this moment, and even that is to say too much, but that covers all moments. Everything is just this moment. Our life is always fundamentally the feeling of this moment, this present moment. And there's just this happening of this present moment, this apparent happening of the present moment. There's no way of saying anything at all about it. So ultimately, from a non-dual expression or sensibility, there isn't any conditioned mind or unconditioned mind. There isn't any ignorance, and there isn't any enlightenment. It's the falling out of all of those stories, or the melting away of the legitimacy of those stories. The apparent stories themselves don't disappear, but it's the realization, the apparent realization, that there's no way of saying anything at all about this happening of the moment, this event of the moment, this sense of presence. And these words aren't meant to describe this, they're just pointing to this. Even if all the thoughts fall away, there is this impression of a vibrant, luminous happening. Simply happening. And within the limitation of thought, of apparent thought, in expressing this, this is the best I can do. So I don't know if that clarifies anything for this person who's written in, but it's all that's happening in this moment. Okay, another person has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, the storylines that are being played out here seem to be a little bizarre and paradoxical. I have been in a relationship with a lovely woman for the past 2 years who is being expressed as a devout Catholic, while I appear to be expressed in the Advaita, or a non-dual sensibility, as you sometimes put it. When we get to discussing our various viewpoints, especially as regards responsibility and free will, she seems to agree that we don't create ourselves or any of the circumstances in our lives, and that everything is God's will. Everything except the ability of man to choose to do good or evil. Apparently this is what is taught in the Bible and by the priests. Now it is understood that it isn't really her that is expressing these views, and that there is only this, with a capital T, doing what it does in any apparent moment. So it is also this, with a capital T, that finds this thinking bizarre and nonsense, although I don't come out and say this. I guess I'm just babbling on and don't really have a question per se. However, I can't help feeling that I would like to find some common ground, if you will. Your comments would be appreciated." All right. Yeah, this is ultimately within, from a non-dual sensibility, we are going to be faced with the fact that within the world of apparent form, Each and every one of us is a unique expression. Everything in existence is unique. And even though there are many apparent forms that are similar to others, they are never exactly the same. So one of the things that we will have to acknowledge is that each and every apparent human being is unique in their apparent sensibility. And whereas from the usual worldly view, we often have the impression that love is going to overcome certain differences or certain difficulties, and that it can overcome all such difficulties. And yet that's not the case, that each and every one of us is unique, and we will get along if life expresses us in a way that's similar enough to allow us to get along. And often, even in cases where there is only what appears to be a subtle difference, that subtle difference can be overwhelming and impossible to live with. I don't know how this particular situation is going to play out. If this person who's a Catholic has connected with those portions of the Bible that really do express that we're not in charge of our lives, that we don't create ourselves, and that everything is God's will, and then at the same time is saying, well, almost everything, that we still choose to do good or evil, I don't know how you're going to get that particular person to acknowledge that everything is simply the expression of the great event or the great spirit. And that includes choices, you know, apparent choices of good or evil. But that itself is not anyone's personal doing. There are phrases in the Bible that say that, you know, there are many different kinds of abilities and different kinds of work and different kinds of activities, but it's the same God that works all of that in all men, in all people. However, it's still the case that somebody can read that and end up saying, yeah, but we still choose to do good or evil, and it's entirely up to us to overcome our evil side in order to get our reward in heaven. Even though it's very clearly stated in the Bible that God's kingdom is existing right now, and it's just a matter of not seeing it. And that whatever happens is it happens through the Great Spirit. So I really have no idea whether these two people can come to agree on their worldly view or their sense of existence. And I don't really know what. I mean, you can't sit and try to convince somebody of something if that isn't their natural way of relating to life. I think I'm going to be sending through some quotations from the Bible relating to non-duality. I hope to have Marcus present that on the website at some point soon. And that might be something that these people might consider together. But again, if life expresses one of us one way and expresses another one of us another way, there's absolutely nothing we're going to be able to do about it if it presents some discrepancy in our world or our sense of existence. All right, I had another person write in who he actually sent in a couple of phrases that didn't seem to be quite complete, and I wondered if I had missed something. So I wrote back asking if there was more to the question, and this person responded by saying, "The questions no longer arise, so no answers are needed, but still I find my apparent self apparently dissatisfied with the usefulness of my own barking when asked about my apparent experience. What seems perfectly clear to me before I open my mouth seems perfectly garbled in translation. When I hear it from you, it's quite clear. When I hear it from me, I realize how much better it would be just to offer a flower." So in the face of the utter inadequacy of language to convey anything of the apparent happening, how does one speak and why? Thanks. Okay, so yeah, this seems perfectly clear. This person is saying that whatever explanation he gives for existence, it doesn't seem to really make any sense whatsoever, and that ultimately we don't have any tool to really say anything at all that's true about existence. So he's wondering, like, how does one speak with that sensibility, and why? And once again, we don't really ultimately have to be concerned about that, because in certain apparent situations, we are going to speak, and existence is going to present certain apparent words, and we will respond to an apparent situation in the same way that an echo would arise in nature, or, you know, in the same way that, you know, if we shout out into a canyon, automatically there's a response of this echo. And so it is that our response occurs in existence. Or another person has described it as being, you throw a rubber ball against a wall and it automatically bounces back. So if a so-called external situation presents itself to our so-called internal process, there's an automatic response. There's no why for it. So for instance, in this situation, it seems as though it's Daryl responding to a number of questions that have been written in. But that's not really the case. I don't really know what's happening here. There's no way of saying what this is at all, but it happens. It's a compelled expression of existence. Existence, the happening of this moment, compulsively expresses itself the way it expresses itself. It has no particular form. What we would call the apparent movement of existence is simply an ongoing happening that has no apparent form, or has no actual form, I should say. There's an apparent form. So the word motion or movement, simply, you know, which we can all relate to. We can all relate to this notion of life being constant change, of everything moving and shifting and dancing. But another way of considering that is that to say that everything is constant motion is simply to say that whatever this is has no actual form. It's the constant absence of form. So what we might call the presence of change is the constant absence of form, and the total absence of form would be also the absence of any notion of change. So change itself or motion itself is drawn into question when we consider this absence of form. So we're left with this. And if in this moment it presents itself this way, there's no way of saying anything at all about it. We don't need to ask why it presents itself in this way, because it's a compulsive expression. Whatever way it expresses itself is the only way it can express itself. It's just this, doing what it does, and there's no way of saying what that is in any way whatsoever. So once more, I don't know if that clarifies the point, or perhaps it just garbles the point, but it's all that's arising. Another person has written in saying, "Hello, Daryl. Many thanks for your communications about the way of things. It resounds deeply with me. In recent years, a lot seems to have dropped away and been seen through, but there still seems to be something that assumes it is. That assumes it is the doer and controller, even though that has been seen through too on some level. Recently, when I woke up one morning, there was just the openness that the doer, there was just the openness. Then the doer was seen to jump in so clearly and start to take over. I hadn't seen it so starkly before. It was as if it had broken cover. Since then, it seems to have been doing what it does with even more determination and driving me to distraction. As I write this, it has all the hallmarks of a story, but knowing this doesn't ease the discomfort. Any comments, please?" Okay, with this, it can be the case that within the apparent storylines, within the apparent experience of the moment, that when the sense of a controller or a doer is being seen through, this is also accompanied by a resurgence of this, the sense of a doer wanting to maintain control comes on stronger than ever. And really, all that's possible is a simple acknowledgement that that itself is also the expression of this larger unexplainable happening of the moment. And so, again, the freedom that's being offered in a non-dual perspective, or the freedom that may seem to arise in a non-dual sensibility, is that all of it is simply the dance of nature. It's the expression of the river of life, the great spirit, the unformed ocean of existence. And that it's not a matter that we're going to get rid of ideas or that we're going to get rid of storylines, but we may come to realize that the apparent movement of those apparent storylines is also simply a totally mysterious event operating on its own. And so there may be the notion, the belief that there is actually a describable doer may push itself forward very strongly at times, and that's also going to simply be a passing expression. It won't always have this urgent intensity. And so if we simply keep acknowledging that fundamentally there is just this totally mysterious happening presenting itself the way it does, at some point any particular expression of urgency or intensity will fade away, like the rising and passing of any of the waves on the unformed ocean of existence. And that's why they use this kind of metaphor, where all the apparent things or all the apparent events are simply waves arising and passing away on a fundamentally an unformed ocean. Because it is very much like what we would ordinarily consider to be an ocean, this large body of water, and the apparent forms of a wave, the identifiable forms of a wave, are simply that same water. It's never anything but the one body of water expressing itself the way it does. And so with this, even when the sense of a doer pushes itself forward in order to exert itself even more strongly, that itself is simply the mysterious movement of this larger event of existence, the larger unformed ocean of existence. And you see, the questioning of the doership, the arising of a non-dual sensibility, is also the movement of this larger unformed ocean of existence. Either you're expressed in this way or you're not expressed in this way. So even the apparent movement towards a non-dual sensibility is not our doing. So it's not a matter that we're successfully guiding ourselves to a non-dual sensibility and then there is this annoyance of a sense of doership reasserting itself. It's that the whole thing is simply the dance of this mysterious event of existence. And all that ever can be acknowledged is that all of it is the dance of this existence. And it will play out in whatever way it plays out. To acknowledge the greater mysterious dance of this moment, to acknowledge that there is only a totally unexplainable happening, doesn't get rid of difficult expressions. It simply acknowledges that both the apparently good and bad events are all the dance of this greater mysterious event or dynamic or function or greater mysterious ocean. And it's simply playing out the way it plays out. All that can ever be acknowledged is a totally unexplainable dance, dancing the way it dances. All right, and last but not least, someone has written in saying, "Dear Daryl, I wish you happy holidays and nice expressions of life. I have two questions for you. Is fantasy and our belief in fantasy also the expression of existence?" That's the first question. And flat out, I'll just say yes. From a non-dual perspective, the whole notion of fantasy and the whole notion that we have a belief in fantasy, that's also the expression of existence. That's also a fantasy. It's simply the totally unexplainable happening of this, whatever this is, just this happening. And then this person's second question is, "One of Taoism's most important concepts is Wu Wei, which is sometimes translated as non-doing or non-action. A better way to think of it, however, is as a paradoxical action of non-action. Wu Wei refers to the cultivation of a state of being in which our actions are quite effortlessly in alignment with the ebb and flow of the elemental cycles of the natural world. It is a kind of going with the flow that is characterized by great ease and awakeness, in which, without even trying, we're able to respond perfectly to whatever situations arise. What is Wu Wei according to your presentation? Thank you very much." Okay, from my presentation, I'm not going to try to get you to cultivate the ability to go with the flow, because there is only the flow. You can't bring yourself into alignment with existence, because you don't exist as anything out of alignment with existence. It doesn't matter what is expressed from a non-dual sensibility. It doesn't matter what arises. It is only the flow of existence. There isn't anybody who exists as anything apart from the flow of existence. So all of these apparent storylines that we have of human beings that aren't in alignment with their true nature, all of that's fantasy. And within the world of Taoism, it's not always the case that you have teachers trying to teach you to gain the ability to go with the flow. That's a development that came along after the original philosophical arising, or the original apparent arising of philosophical Taoism. Characters such as Lao Tzu and Xuanzi and Liu Tzu, those early teachers, the core element of their teaching was that you simply had to acknowledge that everything is the movement of nature. You didn't have to acknowledge it, but you may acknowledge it if you considered life and you considered how it was presenting itself, that there is never a you doing anything. So this idea that there's a you that's going to learn to live life effortlessly, that doesn't make any sense. Because there is no you other than the expression of existence. There is only the flow of nature, the river of life, the unformed ocean of existence, the totally unexplainable happening, this happening right now, right here, right now, this happening, happening the way it happens. There's no way to say what it is. But in certain apparent situations, it becomes quite obvious that it's not any particular form. It's not anyone's doing. There is no you apart from the event. There is only this totally mysterious event, eventing. All of this happens effortlessly. So the moments of great confusion and what seem to be great efforting on your part, all of that arises effortlessly. The situation of you struggling with existence, straining with every apparent molecule of your everything that you are, straining to understand existence, straining and struggling with existence, all of that arises effortlessly, because the whole thing is simply the automatic dance of this larger mysterious expression of existence. So that the arising of apparent difficulties, the arising of a particular response to those difficulties, all of that is the automatic dance of, or the automatic expression of whatever this is. Just this happening, happening. It's always simply a totally unexplainable happening, happening. There isn't anyone making it happen. Everything that we are is an expression of this happening. We don't create our body, we don't create our brain, we don't create our needs, we don't create our interests, we don't create our concerns, we don't create our abilities, and we don't create our lack of abilities. And in fact, if there is an urge to explore any of that, we perhaps come to realize that there isn't any body, there isn't any brain, there aren't any needs, there aren't any interests, there aren't any concerns, there aren't any abilities, and there aren't any lack of abilities. There's just this totally unexplainable happening, simply happening the way it happens. And even that is saying too much. There's just this. And even that is saying too much. There isn't any doing, there isn't any doer. there isn't any doer that has to bring himself or herself into alignment with the rest of nature. It's just this, a totally unexplainable happening. Just this. And as always, what I'm apparently presenting here is simply for your consideration. I'm not asking anyone to believe this. I'm not saying that everyone is supposed to be this sensibility, a non-dual sensibility is not the one true expression of existence or the one and only expression of existence. It's simply one of the many mysterious expressions of existence. So that brings us to the end of what has been sent in this month. And just in closing, I would like to comment on one of the aspects of this acknowledgement is that with this acknowledgement of this mysterious happening of the moment, this happening now, this sense of presence, this event. And when I use the word event, I'm not saying, pointing to any specific event. It's just this impression that something is happening now that has no form, that no one is doing, nothing is causing it. It's just happening. That one could say it's happening according to its nature. So within the world of, this last person had mentioned Taoism, the word Tao is most literally translated as the word way, the way. So there's just the way that this moment is presenting itself. It's presenting itself according to its nature. There is only its way. Now that's, one might say it's an invisible path. It's like birds following their migration route. It's like there's no actual path for those birds to follow, and yet they are expressed in a certain way. So there's just that way that's being expressed. And it's here that there may arise a great sense of rest, because ultimately there's just the way that life expresses itself. There's no person that's influencing that expression, because all apparent people are simply the expressions of this event being expressed the way the event expresses itself. There's just the way. I'll sometimes talk about life being the great compulsion, because there's a compulsive way that it expresses itself. And everything that arises, everything that apparently arises, is that great compulsion, the compulsion of nature itself to express itself in a particular way. And the acknowledgement of that may be accompanied by a great sense of rest. There's just the way life expresses itself. Nothing can actually be said about that. There's just the way it happens. Again, this is a subtle point. It's just for your consideration. So once more, Happy New Year, whatever that means. I'm wishing you all the best, but I know you're going to get a mixed bag of things. So I've got to go get shaved and get off to work. Thanks for tuning in, and see you later. Bye.